Chapter 7. The Voyage. As the trolley passed through the long section of tunnel marked with bright yellow paint on the floor and walls, the helmsman couldn't pretend any longer not to hear the radiation dosimeter clicking faster and faster. He took hold of the brake and muttered apologetically,
"Comrade Colonel, we can't go any further without protection."
"Let's go just another 100 meters,
Denis Mikhailovich suggested gently, turning to face him.
"I'll release you from watch duty for a week afterwards as a hazard bonus."
"But this is the extreme limit, Comrade Colonel,"
the helmsman whined, still not daring to reduce speed.
"Stop," Hunter ordered. "We'll walk on from here." "He's quite right. The radiation level is really getting too high."
The brake block squealed, the lantern hanging on the frame swayed, and the trolley came to a halt. The brigadier and the old man, who were sitting with their legs dangling over the edge, climbed down onto the tracks. The heavy protective suits, made of lead-impregnated fabric, looked like deep-sea divers' outfits. They were incredibly expensive and rare, probably less than 2 dozen of them could be found in the entire metro. The two at Sebastopol had almost never been used, they'd just been waiting for their time to come. These suits of armor could absorb the fiercest radiation, but they turned even simple walking into a difficult task. At least they did for Homer. Denis Mikhailovich left the trolley and walked on with them for a few minutes, swapping phrases with Hunter, snatches of speech that were deliberately clipped and crumpled so that Homer couldn't unfold and interpret them.
"Where will you get them?"
he asked the brigadier gruffly.
"They'll give me them. They won't have any choice,"
Hunter boomed, looking straight ahead.
"Everyone stopped expecting you back ages ago. For them, you're dead. Dead, you understand?"
Hunter stopped for a moment and spoke in a low voice, as if he were talking to himself, not the perimeter commander.
"If only it was all that simple."
"And desertion from the Order? That means a fate worse than death."
Without answering, the brigadier swung his hand up, simultaneously saluting the colonel and lopping off an invisible anchor cable. Denis Mikhailovich took the hint and stayed behind on the dockside while the brigadier and the old man moved slowly away from the shore, as if they were fighting a reverse current, and set off on their great voyage across the seas of darkness. The colonel lowered his hand from his temple and signaled to the helmsman to start the engine. He felt desolate, left with no one to issue ultimatums to and no one to wage battle against. As the military commander of an island lost in one of those dark seas, all he could hope for now was that the little expedition wouldn't get lost out there, and would return home someday, from the other side, proving in its own small way that the world really was round. The final guard post, located in the stretch of tunnel immediately after Kakhova, had been almost deserted. For as long as the old man could remember, no one had ever attacked Sebastopol from the east. Now the patch of yellow seemed less like a marker dividing the endless concrete intestine into arbitrary sections than a cosmic lift connecting two planets that were hundreds of light-years apart. Beyond it, the inhabitable space of Earth was imperceptibly replaced by a dead lunar landscape, and the apparent resemblance between them was a deception. As he focused on setting one foot in front of the other in his incredibly heavy boots, and listened to his own strenuous breathing penned into a complex system of fluted tubes and filters, Homer imagined he was an astronaut who had landed on a satellite of some distant star. Indulging in this puerile fantasy made it easier for him to adjust to the weight of his suit. He could explain that by the high gravity, as well as the fact that they would be the only living creatures in the tunnels for kilometers ahead. All the scientists and science fiction writers never got their forecasts of the future right, thought the old man. By the year 2034, the human race should have been master of half the galaxy, or at least the solar system, for a long time already. Homer had been promised that when he was a child. But the science fiction writers and the scientists had both started from the premise that humanity was rational and consistent, as if it didn't consist of several billions of lazy, frivolous individuals who were easily distracted, but was some kind of beehive endowed with collective reason and a unified will, as if when it set about conquering space, it had really intended to take the task seriously and not abandon it halfway when the game got boring, turning its attention to electronics and then moving on to biotechnology without ever achieving any really impressive results in anything, except perhaps for nuclear physics. So here he was, a wingless astronaut, a non-viable life form without his cumbersome protective suit, an alien on his own planet, exploring and conquering the tunnels from Kakhova to Kashira. And he and all the other survivors could simply forget about anything more ambitious than that. It was strange. Here, beyond the yellow marker, his body groaned under the 50% increase in the force of gravity, but his soul was soaring, weightless. The day before, when he said goodbye to Elena before the expedition to Tula, he was still counting on coming back. But when Hunter named Homer again, choosing him as his partner for the second time in a row, the old man had realized there was no way he could weasel out of it. His insistent prayers to be tested and enlightened had finally been heard, and trying to back out now would be stupid and unmanly. He couldn't treat his life's work as a part-time job. It was pointless to play coy with destiny, promising to devote himself to his work wholeheartedly a bit later on, the next time around. There might not be any next time, and if he didn't set his mind to it now, what would he carry on living for afterwards? To end his days as the unknown Nikolai Ivanovich, a local crackpot, a drooling old storyteller with an erratic smile? But to make the transition from a grotesque caricature of Homer to the genuine article, from an obsessive fantasist to a maker of myths, to rise out of the ashes renewed first, he would have to cremate his former self. He realized that if he carried on doubting and started pandering to his yearning for a home and a woman, if he constantly looked back, he was certain to miss something very important up ahead. He had to wield the knife. It would be difficult for him to return from this new expedition unharmed, or even to return at all, and though he felt terribly sorry for Elena, who couldn't believe at first that Homer had reappeared at the station alive and well after only one day away, and then cried when she failed to change his mind and saw him off again into oblivion, this time he hadn't promised her anything. As he hugged Elena tight against him, he looked over her shoulder at the clock. He had to go. Homer knew it wasn't easy to amputate more than 10 years of life just like that. He was bound to suffer phantom pains after the loss. He had expected to feel the urge to look round all the time, but once he stepped beyond that thick, yellow boundary marker, it was as if he had already died, and his soul had soared free, breaking out of both of its ponderous, unwieldy physical shells. He had escaped. Hunter didn't seem to be hampered at all by his protective suit. The loose clothing bulked out his muscular, wolfish figure, transforming it into an amorphous colossus, but without reducing its agility. He walked along side by side with the panting old man, but only because he was still keeping a close eye on him after Nakhimov Prospekt. After what Homer had seen at Nagatino, Nagornaya, and Tula, agreeing to carry on roaming the tunnels with Hunter hadn't been an easy decision. But he had found a way to convince himself. The long-awaited metamorphosis heralding his rebirth had begun while he was with the Brigadier. And it didn't matter why Hunter had dragged him along again, to set the old man on the right path or to use him for spare rations. The most important thing for Homer now was not to let this new condition slip away, to exploit it while he still could, to invent things and write them down. And another thing, when Hunter asked him to come, Homer seemed to sense that the Brigadier needed him in almost exactly the same way. Not in order to guide him through the tunnels and warn him about the dangers. Perhaps, in nourishing the old man's energies, the Brigadier was also taking something from Homer without asking permission. But what could he possibly need? Hunter's apparent lack of emotion could no longer deceive the old man. Under the crust of that paralyzed face, magma was seething, occasionally splashing out through the craters of those smoldering eyes that didn't close. He was in turmoil. He was searching for something, too. Hunter seemed to fit the role of the future book's epic hero. Homer had hesitated for a while, and then, after the first few trials, accepted him. But there were many things about the Brigadier's character, such as his passion for killing living things, the words he left unspoken, and his miserly gestures that made the old man wary. Hunter was like those killers who taunted and provoked the police detectives, wanting to be unmasked. Homer didn't know if Hunter saw him as a confessor, a biographer, or an organ donor, but he sensed that this strange relationship of dependence was developing into something mutual, growing stronger than fear. And Homer was haunted by the feeling that Hunter was putting off a very important conversation. Sometimes the brigadier turned to him as if he was about to ask something, and never actually spoke. But then perhaps the old man was merely indulging in wishful thinking, and Hunter was leading him on deeper into the tunnel so that he could wring an unwanted witness's neck. More and more often the brigadier's eyes turned to probe the old man's knapsack, with a fateful diary lying in the bottom of it. He couldn't see it, but he seemed to guess that some object hidden in the knapsack attracted Homer's thoughts like a magnet, and he was tracking those thoughts, gradually closing in on the notepad. The old man tried not to think about the diary, but it was futile. There had been almost no time to pack for the journey, and Homer had only been able to hide away with the diary for a few minutes, not long enough to moisten and unstick the pages fused together with blood. But the old man had leafed rapidly through the other pages, criss-crossed haphazardly with hasty, fragmentary entries. The timeline was disrupted, as if the writer had to struggle to catch the words and had simply set them down on paper wherever he could. To render them meaningful, the old man had to arrange them in the right order.
"We have no lines of communication. The phone is dead. Perhaps it's sabotage. One of the exiles, in revenge, before we got here. The situation is hopeless. We can't expect help from anywhere. If we ask Sebastopol, we'll be condemning our own men. We have to endure it. For how long? They won't let me go. They've gone insane. If not me, then who? Make a run for it."
And there was something else, too. Immediately after the final entry, calling for the idea of storming Tula to be abandoned, there was a blurred signature sealed with a bloody fingerprint, like reddish-brown sealing wax. It was a name that Homer had heard before, one he had often spoken himself. The diary belonged to the signal officer of the team sent to Tula a week before. They passed the opening of a track leading to an engine depot, which would certainly have been plundered if not for the intense radiation here. For some reason, the black, wilted branch line leading to it had been screened off by someone with sections of steel reinforcement bars, welded together rather clumsily and very clearly in a hurry. A metal plate attached to the bars with wire bore a grinning skull and the remains of a warning written in red paint, but it had either faded with time or been scraped off. Homer's gaze drew him past the barred entrance, deep into this dark well, and he barely managed to scramble back out. The line probably hadn't always been as empty of life as they believed at Sebastopol, he thought to himself. They passed through Warsaw Station, a terrible, eerie place, rusty and moldy like a drowned man fished out of the water. The walls, patterned in squares of tiles, were oozing murky water. Through the half-open lips of the hermetic doors, a cold wind blew in from the surface, as if someone huge had set his mouth to them from the outside and was giving the station artificial respiration. Their radiation meters fluttered hysterically, telling them they had to get out of there immediately. Closer to Kashira, one of the instruments broke down and the figures on the other were jammed against the very edge of the display. Homer felt a bitter taste on his tongue.
"Where's the epicenter?"
It was incredibly difficult to make out the brigadier's voice, as if Homer had his head lowered into a bath full of water. He stopped, in order to make the best of this short break, and gestured to the southeast with his glove.
"Besides Kantemirov Station, we think the roof of the entrance pavilion or a ventilation shaft was pierced. No one knows for certain."
"So Kantemirov's deserted, then?"
"And always has been. After Kolomenskaya, the entire line's empty."
"But I was told,"
Hunter said, then broke off, gesturing to Homer to be quiet, while he tuned in to his subtle, invisible wavelengths.
"Does anyone know what's happening at Kashira?"
he asked eventually.
"How could they?"
The old man wasn't sure he'd managed to give an ironic note to the adenoidal boom that emerged from his breathing filters like a trombone snorting.
"I'll tell you. The radiation there is so bad, we'll both be fried to a crisp before we even reach the station. Nothing will do any good. We can't go that way. We're turning back."
"Back? To Sebastopol?"
"Yes. I'll go up onto the surface and try to get there overland."
Hunter replied thoughtfully, already figuring out his route.
Are you going to go alone?
Homer asked cautiously.
I can't keep rescuing you all the time. I'll have enough to do saving my own skin. And two of us wouldn't get through anyway. Even for me, there's no guarantee.
You don't understand. I need to go with you. I have to...
Homer cast around frantically for a reason, a toehold in logic.
You have to die with meaning,
the Brigadier concluded for him indifferently. Although Homer knew perfectly well that it was really the filters in the gas mask screening out any contaminants, letting in only tasteless, sterile air, and letting out only soulless, mechanical voices. The old man squeezed his eyes shut for a moment, trying to recall everything he knew about the contaminated lower end of the Zamoskvoretsky branch, about the route from Sebastopol to Serpukhov. Anything at all in order to avoid turning back, to avoid returning to his meager life, to his false pregnancy with the great novel and timeless legends.
Follow me,
he wheezed suddenly and set off, hobbling with an agility that surprised even him, to the east, toward Kashira, into the very mouth of hell. She dreamed she was scraping a file across one loop of the steel shackles chaining her to a wall. The file squealed and kept slipping off, and even when she already thought its blade had bitten half a millimeter into the steel, the moment she stopped working, the shallow, almost invisible groove closed up as she watched. But Sasha didn't despair. She took up her tool again, skinning her palms as she filed away at the unyielding metal, maintaining a strict, regular rhythm. The important thing was not to lose the rhythm, not to stop working even for an instant. In the tight grip of the fetters, her ankles had swollen up and gone numb. Sasha realized that even if she could defeat the metal, she still wouldn't be able to run away because her legs would refuse to obey her. Sasha woke up and raised her eyelids with a struggle. The shackles had not been a mere dream. Her wrists were restrained by handcuffs. She was lying on the dirty floor of an old mining trolley that squealed with excruciating monotony as it crept slowly along. There was a dirty piece of rag stuffed in her mouth, and the side of her head was throbbing and bleeding.
He didn't kill me, she thought. Why not?
From where she was lying, all she could see was a small section of the ceiling, the welded joints of tunnel liners drifting by in an irregular patch of light. The trolley was moving along a tunnel. While she tried to get her shackled hands out from behind her back, the liners were replaced by flaking white paint. That alarmed Sasha. What station was this? It was a bad place, not just quiet, but desolate, not just deserted, but lifeless, and completely dark. For some reason, she had thought every station on the other side of the bridge was full of people, and the air everywhere was filled with their shouting and hubbub. So she must have been wrong about that. The ceiling above Sasha stopped moving. Grunting and swearing, her kidnapper clambered down onto the platform and strolled about with his metal-tipped heels scraping as if he was studying the surroundings. Then, obviously having removed his gas mask, he growled in a deep, amiable-sounding voice.
So here we are, then, after all these years.
Releasing all the air out of his lungs in a long, lingering sigh, he hit out hard at some bulky, inanimate object. No, he kicked it with his boot. It looked like a sack, but what was it stuffed with? When Sasha realized the answer, she sank her teeth into the stinking rag and started bellowing, arching up her body as if she was having a fit. She knew where the fat man in tarpaulin had brought her, and who he was talking to like that. It was ludicrous even to hope he could get away from Hunter. Moving like a lion, the Brigadier overtook the old man in a few long bounds, grabbed hold of his shoulder and shook him painfully.
What's wrong with you?
We only have to go a little bit further.
Homer wheezed.
I've remembered. There's an access passage from here straight to the Zamoskvoretsky line, just before Kashira station. We can go through it straight to the tunnel, so we don't have to go into the station. We'll bypass it and come straight out at Kolomenskoye. It shouldn't be very far. Please.
Seizing his chance, he tried to break free again, but stumbled over the bell-bottoms of his trousers and fell flat onto the rails with a crash. He got up again immediately and tried to jerk forward, but Hunter easily held him still on the spot, like a rat on a string, and turned the old man to face him. Leaning down so that the lenses of their gas masks were on the same level, he glanced deep into Homer for a few seconds, and then released his grip.
All right.
And now the Brigadier dragged him along, not halting again for a single moment. The blood pounding in Homer's ears drowned out the frenetic chattering of the dosimeters, his legs turned stiff and numb, almost refusing to obey him. His lungs were straining so hard they smarted painfully and felt as if they were about to burst. They almost missed the black ink blot of the narrow passage. Squeezing into it, they ran for a few more long minutes until Hunter galloped out into a new tunnel. The Brigadier cast a hasty glance around, dived back into the passage, and shouted to the old man.
"Where's this you brought me to? Have you ever even been here?"
About 30 meters along to the left of the passage, in the direction they had to follow, the tunnel was blocked from floor to ceiling by a thick curtain of something that looked like cobwebs. Reluctant to waste his breath on talking, Homer simply shook his head. It was absolutely true. He'd never had any reason to come this way before, and this was hardly the moment to tell Hunter all the things he'd heard about this place. Throwing his automatic back over his shoulder, the Brigadier took a long rectangular hatchet, something like a homemade machete, out of his knapsack, and slashed at the sticky white lacework. The dried-out skeletons of flying cockroaches that were stuck in the nets started quivering and rustling like hoarse little bells. The edges of the ragged wound that had been inflicted immediately closed together as if it was healing up. Turning back the semi-transparent fabric of the web and sticking his flashlight inside, the Brigadier lit up the passage. It would take them hours to clear it. The multi-layered webbing of sticky threads filled every part of the connecting tunnel for as far as the beam of light could reach. Hunter checked his radiation monitor, made a strange guttural sound and started furiously hacking away the thread stretched between the walls of the tunnel. The cobweb yielded slowly, taking more time than they could afford now. In 10 minutes, they only managed to move about 30 meters forward, and the threads were woven ever more tightly, choking the passage like a plug of cotton wool. Finally, at an overgrown ventilation shaft with an ugly two-headed skeleton lying on the sleepers below it, the Brigadier flung his hatchet down on the floor. They were stuck in the web, just like the cockroaches, and even if the creature that wove these nets had perished long ago and wouldn't come for them, they would die soon anyway, from the radiation. In a few moments, while Hunter was trying to decide what to do, the old man remembered something else he had once heard about this tunnel. Going down on one knee, he knocked a few cartridges out of his spare clip, twisted the bullets out using a penknife, and shook the powder into his palm. Hunter didn't need any explanations. A few minutes later, back at the beginning of the connecting tunnel, they tipped a heap of gray granules onto a small pad of cotton wool and held a cigarette lighter to it. The gunpowder snorted and started smoking, and suddenly something incredible happened. The flame from the powder spread out in all directions at once, climbing right up the walls to the distant ceiling, invading all the space of the tunnel. It dashed inwards, devouring the cobweb, a roaring, blazing ring of fire, lighting up the grimy tunnel liners and leaving behind only occasional burnt tatters dangling from the ceiling. The hoop of flame moved towards Kolomenskoye, shrinking rapidly and sucking in air like a gigantic piston. Then the tunnel swerved and the flames disappeared round the bend, trailing bright crimson flashes behind them. And from the far distance, breaking through the regular drone of the fire, came a call that wasn't human, something between a despairing howl and a strident hiss. Although Homer, hypnotized by the spectacle, could easily have imagined it. Hunter tossed the hatchet back into his knapsack and took out 2 new unopened canisters for gas masks.
"I was keeping them for the way back," he said, changing his own filter and handing the second canister to the old man. "After that fire, the pollution in there now is like the place had just been bombed."
The old man nodded. When the flames swirled upwards, they'd stirred up radioactive particles that had been settling into the cobweb for years, eating their way into its threads. The black vacuum of the tunnel was now filled with deadly molecules suspended in the air like millions of tiny underwater mines, and they had blocked off the Voyager's navigable channel. There was no possible way to avoid them. They had to break straight through.
If only your dad could see you now.
The fat man scolded her derisively. Sasha was sitting directly opposite her father's overturned body, which was lying face down in the blood. Both straps of her overalls had been tugged down off her shoulders, revealing a washed-out singlet with a picture of some jolly little animal. Her kidnapper wouldn't let her see his face. He seared her eyes with a brilliant beam of light every time she tried to look up. He'd taken the rag out of her mouth, but Sasha still had no intention of asking him for anything.
Not like your mother, unfortunately, and I was really hoping.
The elephantine legs in the blood-smeared knee-boot set off again round the column that Sasha was sitting against. Now his voice came from behind her back.
Your daddy probably thought that in time everything would be forgotten, but some crimes don't carry a statute of limitation. Slander. Betrayal.
His obese figure emerged from the gloom on the other side of her. He stopped, looking down on her father's body, prodding it contemptuously with his boot. He hacked up spittle and spat out a generous gobbet.
It's a shame the old fellow snuffed it without my help,
said the fat man, running the beam of his flashlight round the heaps of useless junk that cluttered the bleak, faceless station and halting it on the bicycle with no wheels.
A cozy little place you have here. I think if it wasn't for you, your daddy would have preferred to hang himself.
While the flashlight was directed away from her, Sasha tried to crawl off to the side, but a second later the beam picked her out of the darkness again.
And I can understand him, said her kidnapper.
With a single bound, he was there beside her again.
You've turned out a fine little girl. It's just a shame you're not like your mum. I think he was probably disappointed about that, too. Well, never mind, he said, knocking her to the floor with the toe of his boot. At least I didn't waste my time coming all the way through the metro to get here.
Sasha shuddered and shook her head.
See how unpredictable everything is, Pete?
He said, talking to Sasha's father again.
There was a time when you used to have your rivals in love court-martialed. Thanks, by the way, for not having me executed, merely banished for life. But life is long, and circumstances change, and not always to your advantage. I've come back, even if it has taken me 10 years longer than I planned.
It's never an accident when someone goes back somewhere,
Sasha whispered, repeating her father's words.
How very true that is,
the fat man jeered.
Hey, who's there?
At the far end of the platform, something bulky and ponderous rustled and fell. Then there was a kind of hissing sound, and the stealthy footsteps of a large animal. When silence fell again, it was a false silence, frayed and tattered. Like her kidnapper, Sasha could sense something moving towards them out of the tunnel. The fat man snapped the breech of his gun, went down on one knee beside the girl, pressed the butt into his shoulder, and ran a trembling spot of light over the closest columns. Hearing the southern tunnels come to life after they had been empty for decades was as spine-chilling as seeing the marble statues waking up in one of the central stations of the metro. A blurred shadow flitted across the beam of light just as the beam was turning away. It wasn't human, though. The shape was wrong and the movements were too agile. But when the light moved back to the spot where the mysterious creature had just been, there was no trace of it. A minute later, the beam, fluttering wildly in panic, caught it again, only 20 steps away from them.
There,
the fat man whispered in disbelief, pressing the trigger. Bullets lashed into the columns and started rattling against the walls, but the beast seemed to have dematerialized, and not a single shot found its target. Then the fat man suddenly stopped firing senselessly, dropped his automatic and pressed his hands to his stomach. His flashlight rolled off to one side, casting a cone of light that crept across the floor and lighting up his corpulent, hunched-over figure from below. A man stepped unhurriedly out of the gloom, walking with incredibly soft, almost soundless steps in his heavy boots. In a protective suit that was too large even for a giant like him, he really could have been taken for a bear. He wasn't wearing a gas mask. His scar-furrowed face and shaved head looked like a scorched desert. Part of the face, with hard, coarsely defined, manly features, was even rather handsome, but it looked dead somehow, and Sasha couldn't repress a shudder when she looked at it. The other half was simply repulsive. A complicated tangle of scars transformed it into the half-mask of a folk-tale monster, perfect in its ugly deformity. But even so, apart from the eyes, his appearance was repellent rather than frightening. A half-crazed, prowling, probing gaze enlivened the stiffened face, enlivened it, but didn't bring it to life. The fat man tried to get to his feet, but immediately collapsed on the floor, screaming in pain, shot through both the knees. Then the gunman squatted down beside him, put the silencer on the end of his long pistol barrel against the fat man's head, and pulled the trigger. The howling broke off instantly, but for a few seconds the echo wandered under the vaults of the station like a lost spirit, bereft of its body. The shot had thrown the fat man's chin up, and now Sasha's kidnapper lay there, turned towards her. Instead of a face, he had a damp, gaping, crimson crater. Sasha huddled back and started whimpering in horror. Slowly and thoughtfully, the terrible gunman turned the gun barrel on her. Then he looked round and changed his mind. The pistol disappeared into its holster, and he stepped back as if trying to disown what he had done. He opened a flat flask and took a pull from it. A new character appeared on the small stage, illuminated by the dead man's fading flashlight. An old man who was breathing heavily, clutching at his ribs. He was dressed in the same kind of suit as the killer and looked absolutely absurd in it. When he caught up with his companion, the old man immediately collapsed on the floor in exhaustion, not even noticing that everything around him was awash with blood. It was only later, when he came round and opened his eyes, that he saw the two mutilated bodies and the mute, terrified girl hemmed in between them. Homer's heart had only just calmed down, but now it leapt again. He couldn't express it in words yet, but he already knew for certain. He had found her. After so many nights spent in fruitless attempts to picture his future heroine, trying to imagine her lips and her wrists, her clothes and her aroma, her movements and her thoughts, he had suddenly met a real person who matched all his requirements perfectly. Of course, until now, he had imagined her quite differently. More elegant, more well-rounded, and certainly more grown up. She had turned out to be much more sinewy. She had too many sharp corners, and, glancing into her eyes, instead of languorous, enveloping warmth, the old man encountered two cold splinters of ice. She was different, but Homer knew it was his mistake. He had failed to guess what she ought to be like. Her trapped look, her face distorted by fear, and her manacled hands intrigued the old man. He might be a master at retelling yarns, but he hadn't been granted the talent to write tragedies of the kind that this girl must have suffered. Her helplessness and hopelessness, her miraculous rescue and the way her destiny had been woven into their story, meant that he was on the right track. And though she hadn't spoken a word yet, he was ready in advance to believe her. For after all, apart from everything else, this teenage girl with her white, tousled, carelessly lopped hair, pointed little ears, soot-smeared cheeks and exposed sculpted collarbones, surprisingly white and vulnerable, with her childishly plump, bitten lower lip, was beautiful in a very special way. The old man's curiosity was mingled with pity and a surprising tenderness. He moved closer and squatted down beside her. She huddled away and squeezed her eyes shut. "A little savage," he thought. He patted her on the shoulder, not knowing what to say.
"Time to go," Hunter butted in.
"But what about—"
Homer asked with a nod at the girl.
"Never mind. It's none of our business."
"We can't just abandon her here alone."
"Simpler to shoot her," the brigadier snapped.
"I don't want to go with you,"
the girl said, suddenly pulling herself together.
"Just take the handcuffs off. He should have the key."
She pointed to the shattered, faceless mannequin. In three swift movements, Hunter frisked the body and pulled a bunch of steel keys out of an inside pocket. He tossed them to the girl and looked round at the old man.
Is that all?
Still trying to postpone the parting, Homer spoke to the girl.
What did that subhuman brute do to you?
Nothing,
she said, fiddling with the lock.
He didn't have time. He's not subhuman, just an ordinary human being. Cruel, stupid, spiteful, like all of them.
They're not all like that,
the old man objected, but without any real conviction.
All of them,
the girl said obstinately, wincing as she got up on her numbed legs.
It's all right. Staying human's not that easy.
She'd certainly got over her fright very quickly. She didn't lower her eyes any more. Now she looked at the men with a lowering, challenging gaze. She walked up to one of the corpses, carefully turned it face up, arranged its arms on its chest, and kissed it on the forehead. Narrowing her eyes, she turned to Hunter, and the corner of her mouth trembled.
Thank you.
Without taking any things or even a weapon, she climbed down onto the tracks and limped off towards the tunnel. The brigadier watched her go with his head lowered, frowning. His hand wandered indecisively along his belt between the knife and the flask. Finally, he reached a decision, straightened up, and called to her.
Wait!
Chapter 8. Masks. The cage was still lying where the fat man had knocked it out of her hands. Its little door was slightly open and the rat had fled.
Let him go, the girl thought. The rat deserved his freedom too.
There was nothing else for it, so Sasha had put on her kidnapper's gas mask. She thought there were still traces of his stale breath in it, but she could only be glad he'd taken the mask off before he was shot. Close to the middle of the bridge, the background radiation spiked again. Sasha rattled about in the immense tarpaulin suit like a cockroach larva in a cocoon. It seemed miraculous that it could stay on her. But the gas mask clung firmly to her face, even though it had been stretched across the fat man's broad features and drooping jowls. Sasha tried to blow as hard as she could in order to drive the air predestined for the dead man out through the tubes and filters. But looking around through the perspiring circular lenses, she had an eerie feeling that she had climbed into someone else's body, not just his protective suit. Only an hour ago, the soulless demon who had come for her was in here, and now it was as if, in order to get across the bridge at all, she had been forced to become him and take a look at the world through his eyes. Through the eyes of the men who had banished her and her father to Kolomenskoye, and kept them alive there for all these years only because their greed was stronger than their hate. Sasha wondered whether, in order to get lost among people like that, she too would have to wear a black rubber mask and pretend to be someone with no face and no feelings. If only that would help her to change on the inside, too, and reset her memories to zero. To genuinely believe that she hadn't been damaged beyond repair, that she could still start all over again. Sasha would have liked to think these two men had not picked her up simply by chance, that they had been sent to the station especially for her, but she knew it wasn't true. She found it hard to decide why they had taken her with them, for amusement, out of pity, or to prove something to each other. The few words the old man had tossed to her like a bone to a dog seemed to hint at sympathy, but he did everything with wary deference to his companion, held his tongue, and seemed afraid of being accused of mere common humanity. And the other one, after giving permission for the girl to go with them as far as the nearest inhabited station, had never even looked in her direction again. Sasha had deliberately hung back and let him go ahead slightly, so she could study him freely from behind. He obviously sensed her gaze on him, immediately tensing up and jerking his head back. But he didn't look round, perhaps out of tolerance for a young girl's curiosity, or perhaps because he didn't want to show that he was paying any attention to her. From the powerful build and feral agility of the man with the shaved head, which had made the fat man confuse him with a bear, it was obvious that he was a soldier and a solitary. But it wasn't just a matter of his height or his massive shoulders. He radiated energy, and it would have been just as palpable if he were short and skinny. A man like that could make almost anyone submit to his will, and he would eliminate anyone who disobeyed without compunction. And long before the girl finally mastered her fear of this man, before she even started trying to make sense of him and herself, the unfamiliar voice of the woman awakening within her told Sasha that she would submit too. The trolley moved forward at an incredible pace. Homer could hardly feel the resistance of the levers. All the strain was taken by the brigadier. For form's sake, standing there opposite Hunter, the old man also raised and lowered his hands, but the work cost him no effort at all. The squat metro bridge was like a millipede fording the murky, turbid river. The concrete flesh was peeling off its steel bones, its legs were buckling under it, and one of its two backbones had slumped and collapsed. Standard, functional, and impermanent, it lacked the slightest trace of elegance. Like the residential high-rise developments around it, like all of Moscow's banal, stereotyped suburbs. But gazing round rapturously as he rode across it, Homer recalled the magical, movable bridges of St. Petersburg and the burnished metal lacework of Moscow's Crimea Bridge. In the 20 years he had lived in the metro, the old man had only come up to the surface 3 times, and each time he had tried to observe more than he could possibly see during his short period of leave. Tried to bring his memories to life, focus the lenses of his eyes, already turning cloudy with age, on the city and click the rusting shutter of his visual memory. Tried to store up memories for the future. He might never be up on the surface again.
At Kolomenskoye, Rechnoy Voksal, or Tsyopilistan, in those miraculously beautiful places that he and so many other Muscovites used to regard with such unjustified contempt. Year by year his Moscow was growing older, falling apart, being eroded away. Homer wanted to stroke the decaying metro bridge in the same way as the girl at Kolomenskoye caressed the man who had bled to death for the last time. And not just the bridge, but the grey crags of the factory buildings too. He wanted to gaze at them in endless adoration, to touch them so he could feel that he was really there among them and not just dreaming all this. And also, just in case, to say goodbye to them. The visibility was atrocious. The silvery moonlight couldn't force its way through the filter of dense clouds, and the old man had to guess at more than he could observe. But that was okay. He was well used to substituting fantasies for reality. Completely absorbed in his musings, at that moment Homer wasn't thinking of anything else. He forgot about the legends that he was going to compose, and the mysterious diary that had been harrowing his imagination without a break for so many hours. He behaved just like a child on a holiday outing, gazing in delight at the blurred silhouettes of the high trees, turning his head to and fro, talking out loud to himself. The others got no pleasure from the journey across the bridge. The brigadier, who had taken the forward-facing position, occasionally froze and peered in the direction of sounds that came flying up from below. Apart from that, his attention was riveted to the distant point, still invisible to his companions, where the tracks burrowed back into the earth. The girl sat behind Hunter, for some reason clutching her salvaged gas mask with both hands. It was very obvious that she felt uncomfortable up on the surface. While the team was walking through the tunnel, the girl had seemed quite tall, but the moment they stepped out into the open, she shrank into herself, as if she had withdrawn into an invisible shell, and not even the tarpaulin suit taken from the corpse made her seem any bigger, although it was hideously large for her. She was indifferent to the beautiful views from the bridge, and most of the time she looked straight down at the floor in front of her. They rode through the ruins of Technopark Station, which was being built with careless haste just before the war. It had crumbled away, not because of the nuclear strikes, but simply from the passage of time, and finally approached the tunnel. In the pale darkness of the night, its entrance was black with an absolute blackness. For Homer, his suit was transformed into a genuine suit of armor, and he was a medieval knight riding into a fantastic fairy tale cave, straight into the dragon's lair. The noise of the nighttime city was left behind on the threshold of the beast's abode, at the point where Hunter ordered them to abandon the trolley. All that could be heard now was the tentative rustling of 3 travelers' footsteps, and their sparse words, fractured by an echo that stumbled across the tunnel liners. But there was something unusual about the quality of sound in this tunnel. Even Homer could clearly sense the enclosed nature of the space, as if they had walked in through the neck of a glass bottle.
"It's closed off ahead,"
said Hunter, confirming the old man's fears. The beam of Hunter's flashlight was the first to find the bottom of the bottle. The closed hermetic door loomed up in front of them, a blank wall. Rails glinted faintly, breaking off at the door, and dollops of brownish lubricant oozed from the bearings. Some old planks, dry broken branches, and charred pieces of wood had been dumped right beside the door, as if someone had tried to light a fire there recently. The door was clearly in use, but apparently only for coming out from the inside. There were no bells or any other signaling devices on this side of it. The brigadier looked at the girl.
Is it always like this here?
They come out sometimes. They come to us on the other side. To trade. I thought... today...
She seemed to be making excuses. Had she known there was no access, but kept it a secret. Hunter hammered on the door, with the handle of his machete as if it were a large metal gong. But the steel was too thick, and instead of a resonant chime, it gave out only a feeble clang. That sound almost certainly couldn't be heard on the other side of the wall, even if there was anybody alive there. No miracle happened. There was no answer. In defiance of common sense, Sasha had been hoping these men would be able to unlock the door. She'd been afraid to warn them that the entrance into the greater metro was closed. What if they decided to take a different route and abandoned her where they had found her? But no one in the greater metro was expecting them, and breaking open an hermetic door was beyond the power of any human being. The man with the shaved head examined the massive panel of metal, trying to find a weak point or a secret lock, but Sasha knew there weren't any locks on this side. The door only opened outwards.
You stay there. I'm going to reconnoiter. I'll check the door in the other tunnel and look for ventilation shafts.
The big man barked. After a short pause, he added,
I'll be back.
And then he disappeared. The old man gathered up the branches and planks that were lying around and lit a puny little campfire. He sat down directly on the sleepers, thrust his hands into his knapsack and started rummaging through his belongings. Sasha crouched down quietly beside him, observing. The old man ran through a strange performance, perhaps for her or perhaps for himself. He fished a filthy, battered notepad out of the knapsack, cast a wary glance at Sasha, shifted sideways away from her as far as he could and hunched over the paper. Then he immediately jumped up with suspicious agility for his age to check that the man with the shaved head really had gone. He crept awkwardly about 10 steps towards the exit of the tunnel, didn't find anyone there, and decided that these precautions would be sufficient. Leaning back against the door, he screened himself off from Sasha with a sack and immersed himself in his reading. He read fretfully, droning something indistinctly to himself, then removed his gloves, took out a flask of water, and started sprinkling it on his notepad. He read a bit more, then suddenly started rubbing his hands against his trouser legs, slapped himself fretfully on the forehead, touched his gas mask, and plunged back into his reading. Infected by his agitation, Sasha abandoned her musings and crept closer. The old man was too engrossed to notice her cautious movements. Infused with the light of the campfire, his pale green eyes glinted feverishly even through the lenses of the gas mask. Every now and then he surfaced with an obvious effort for a gulp of air. In these breaks from reading, the old man peered warily at the distant patch of night sky at the end of the tunnel, but it was clear. The man with the shaved head had disappeared completely, and then the notepad engrossed him entirely again. Now she realized why he had sprinkled the paper with water. He was trying to separate pages that were stuck together. They obviously resisted, and once, when he accidentally tore one of them, he cried out as if he had cut himself. He swore, cursing his own clumsiness, and noticed how inquisitively she was examining him. Embarrassed, he adjusted his gas mask again, but didn't say anything to her until he had read right to the end. Then he skipped over to the fire and flung the notepad into it, without even looking at Sasha, and she sensed that it was pointless to ask any questions now. He would only lie or say nothing. And there were other things that worried her far more just at the moment. Probably an entire hour had passed since the man with the shaved head had left. What if he had abandoned them as an unnecessary burden? Sasha moved to sit a bit closer to the old man.
The other tunnel's closed too, she said, and all the shafts nearby have been blocked off. This is the only way in.
The old man looked at her absent-mindedly, clearly struggling to concentrate on what he had heard.
He'll find a way to get inside. He's got intuition, he said,
and a minute later, as if he didn't want to seem impolite, he asked,
What's your name?
Alexandra,
she replied seriously.
What's yours?
Nikolai, he began, reaching out his hand, and then suddenly jerking it back again before Sasha could touch it, as if he had changed his mind.
Homer. My name's Homer.
Homer? That's a strange nickname,
Sasha said slowly.
It's just a name,
Homer said firmly. Should she explain to him that as long as they were with her, the door would stay closed, although it could easily have been standing wide open if these two had come on their own? This was Kolomenskoye refusing to let Sasha go, punishing her for what she had done to her father. The girl had run off and stretched her chain to its limit, but she still couldn't break it. The station had brought her back to itself once, and it would do it again. No matter how hard she tried to drive these thoughts and images away, they only flew off to arm's length, like blood-sucking gnats, but always came back, circling round and round her, creeping into her ears and her eyes. The old man was asking Sasha about something else, but she didn't respond. Her eyes were veiled by tears, and she could hear her father's voice in her ears repeating, "Nothing is more precious than human life." And now the moment had come, when she really understood what he meant. What was going on at Tula was no longer a mystery to Homer. The explanation for everything was simpler and more terrible than he had imagined. But an even more terrible story was only just beginning, now that the notepad had been deciphered. The diary was Homer's black spot. It was a one-way ticket, and once he had held it in his hand, the old man could never be free of it, even if he burned it. And besides that, his suspicions concerning Hunter had now been confirmed by substantial, unambiguous proof, although Homer didn't have the slightest idea what to do with it. Everything he had read in the diary completely contradicted the Brigadier's claims. Hunter was simply lying, and quite deliberately. The old man had to work out what was the motive behind his lies, and if the lies made any kind of sense. The answer to that would determine whether he decided to carry on following Hunter, and whether his adventure would turn out to be a heroic epic or a mindless, horrendous bloodbath that left no surviving witnesses. The first entries in the notepad were dated to the day when the convoy passed through Nagornaya without any casualties and entered Tula without encountering any resistance. The tunnels are quiet and empty almost all the way to Tula. We advance quickly, a good sign. The commander is counting on getting back tomorrow at the latest, the dead signal officer reported. The entrance to Tula is not guarded. We sent in a scout. He disappeared, he wrote anxiously a few hours later. The commander has decided to advance into the station en masse. We are preparing for an assault. And then again a little while later, we can't understand what's wrong. We're talking to the locals. Things are bad here, some kind of disease. And soon after that, he explained, some people at the station are infected with something. An unknown illness. The members of the convoy apparently tried to render assistance to the sick. The paramedic hasn't been able to find a cure. He says it's like rabies. They suffer monstrous pain. They're deranged. They attack other people. And straight after that, weakened by the illness, they can't cause any serious harm. That's not the real disaster. At this point, as luck would have it, the pages had stuck together, and Homer had to sprinkle water on them from his flask. Photophobia, nausea, blood in the mouth, coughing. Then they swell up. They are transformed into... The word had been laboriously crossed out. How it's transmitted is not clear. The air? Physical contact. That entry was made the next day. The detachment had stayed on.
Why didn't they report this?
The old man thought, and immediately realized that he'd already seen the answer somewhere. He leafed through the pages. We have no lines of communication. The phone is dead. Perhaps it's sabotage. One of the exiles in revenge. They discovered it before we got here, and at first they flung the sick out into the tunnels. One of them? Did he cut the cable? At that point, Homer looked up from the letters and stared blindly into space. Let's say the cable was cut. But then, why didn't they come back to Sebastopol?
What's worse is that it takes a week to develop, and what if it's longer? And from then to death is another week or two. We can't tell who's sick and who's well.
Nothing helps. There's no cure. The death rate is 100%. A day later, the signal officer made another entry that was already familiar to Homer. Tula is in chaos. There is no way out to the metro. Hanza is blocking it. We can't go back home. On the next page, he continued, the healthy were shooting at the sick, especially the aggressive ones. They built a pen for infected individuals. They resist and beg to be let out. And after that, a brief, terrible phrase. They gnaw on each other. The signal officer was frightened, too, but the steely discipline in the detachment prevented fear from spilling over into panic. Even at the focus of an epidemic of deadly fever, a Sebastopol brigade remained a Sebastopol brigade. We have brought the situation under control, sealed off the station, and appointed a commandant, Homer read. All our men are all right, but too little time has gone by. The search party dispatched from Sebastopol had reached Tula safely and, of course, got stuck there, too. We have taken a decision to remain here until the incubation period is over to avoid endangering, or forever, the signal officer wrote. The situation is hopeless. We can't expect help from anywhere. If we ask Sebastopol, we'll be condemning our own men. We have to endure it. For how long? So the mysterious guard by the hermetic door at Tula had been posted by the Sebastopolites. Then it wasn't surprising that their voices had seemed familiar to Homer. The watch was being kept by men with whom he had defended the Chertanova line of approach against Upirs only a few days ago. By voluntarily deciding not to return, they hoped to protect their home station from being infected. Most often from person to person, but it's obviously in the air too. Some men seem to be immune. It started a couple of weeks ago. Many have not fallen ill, but there are more and more dead. We are living in a morgue, the signal officer scribbled. Who'll be the next to die? He asked, suddenly breaking into an hysterical shriek. But he took himself in hand and continued steadily. We have to do something. Warn them. I want to volunteer to go, not to Sebastopol, to find the point where the cable is damaged, and get through from there. I have to get a call through. Then several days passed, filled with invisible conflict with the commander of the convoy, silent arguments with other soldiers, and mounting despair. The signal officer gathered his strength, and recorded in his diary everything that he tried to make them see. They don't understand how things look from Sebastopol. We've been blockaded in for a week now. They'll send another three men, who won't be able to go back either. Then they'll send a large assault team. Declare general mobilization. Everyone who comes to Tula will be in the risk zone. Someone will get infected and go running home. And that will be the end. I have to prevent an assault. They don't understand. Then another attempt to get the commandant to see sense, as fruitless as all the others before it. They won't let me go. They've gone insane. If not me, then who? Make a run for it. I pretended that I had calmed down, that I was willing to wait, he wrote a day later. I went on duty at the hermetic door. I shouted that I was going to find a break in the cable and ran. They fired on me. A bullet lodged in my back. Homer turned the page. Not for myself. For Natasha. For little Seryozha. I wasn't thinking of trying to save myself. Let them live, so Seryozha can. At this point, the pen was jerking about in his weakened hand. Perhaps he added this later because there was no more space, or because he no longer cared where he wrote. Then the disrupted chronology was restored. Thank God, they let me through Nagornaya. I have no strength left. I walk on and on. Then I faint. How long was I asleep? I don't know. Is there blood in my lung? Is it the bullets, or have I got the sickness? I can't. The curve of the letters straightened out into a slithering line, like a dying man's encephalogram. But then he came round again and finished the sentence. I can't find where the damage is. Nakhimov, I made it. I know where the phone is.
I'll warn them. They mustn't.
Save. My wife. I miss...
He splashed his thoughts out onto the paper less and less coherently, punctuated with scarlet blobs.
I got through. Did they hear me? I'll die soon. Strange. I'll fall asleep. No more bullets. I want to fall asleep before this... They're standing around me, waiting. I'm still alive. Go away.
The ending of the diary seemed to have been prepared in advance, written in triumphantly vertical handwriting. The appeal not to storm Tula, and the name of the man who had given his life to prevent it happening. But Homer could tell that the last thing the signal officer had written before his signal faded away forever was, I'm still alive. Go away. A heavy silence enveloped the two people huddling close to the flames. Homer had stopped trying to lift the girl's mood. He sat there without speaking, stirring the ashes with a stick, while the sodden notepad died the stubborn death of a heretic, and he tried to ride out the storm that was raging inside him. Fate was mocking him. How he had longed to solve the mystery of Tula, how proud he had been of finding the diary, how it had flattered his vanity to come so close all on his own to unraveling all the knots in this story. And now? Now that he had the answers to all the questions in his hands, he cursed himself for his curiosity. Yes, he was breathing through his respirator when he picked up the diary at Nakhimov Prospekt, and he was wearing a full protection suit now as well, but no one knew exactly how the disease was transmitted. What a fool he had been to scare himself with not having much time left. Yes, it had spurred him on, helped him to overcome his laziness and conquer his fear, but death was contrary. It didn't like people who tried to dictate to it. And now the diary had set him an absolutely definite deadline. A few weeks from the day of infection to death. Perhaps even an entire month. But there was so much he still had to get done in those pitiful 30 days. What should he do? Confess to his companions that he was sick and go away to turn up his toes at Kolomenskoye? If not from the sickness, then from hunger and radiation. But if he was already incubating the terrible disease, then Hunter and the girl with whom he had shared the same air must be infected too, especially the brigadier. When he spoke to the sentries on the cordon at Tula, he had come very close to them. Or should he hope that the sickness would pass him by? Just keep his head down and wait. Not simply lie low, of course, but continue this journey with Hunter, so that the swirling tornado of events that had picked the old man up wouldn't drop him again, and he could carry on drawing inspiration from them. After all, Nikolai Ivanovich, that decrepit, useless, mediocre citizen of Sebastopol and former engine driver's mate, that caterpillar crushed against the ground by the force of gravity, was dying because he had unsealed that cursed diary. Then Homer, the chronicler and mythmaker, the short-lived, bright-winged mayfly, had only just appeared in the world. Perhaps he had been sent a tragedy worthy of the pens of the great, and now it was entirely up to him to see if it could manifest it on paper in the 30 days that had been granted to him. Did he have any right to ignore this chance? Did he have any right to become a hermit, forget about his legend, voluntarily abandon genuine immortality and deprive all his contemporaries of it too? What would be more criminal and more stupid, to carry the blazing torch of the plague through half the metro, or to burn his manuscripts and himself with them? As a vain and cowardly man, Homer had already made his choice. And now he was only searching for arguments to support it. What would be the point of mummifying himself in the vault at Kolomenskoye in the company of two other corpses? He wasn't cut out for feats of heroism, and if the Sebastopol soldiers at Tula were prepared to enlist in the ranks of the dead, that was their choice and their right. At least they didn't have to die alone. And what good would it do if Homer sacrificed himself? He couldn't stop Hunter in any case. The old man had been spreading the disease without knowing what he was doing, but Hunter had known everything perfectly well since that encounter at Tula. That was why he had insisted on the total extermination of all the station's inhabitants, including the men from the Sebastopolite convoys. That was why he had mentioned flamethrowers. And if they were both already sick, the epidemic would inevitably affect Sebastopol. In the first instance, the people they had been with, Elena, the station commandant, the commander of the perimeter, their adjutants. Which meant that in 3 weeks' time, the station would first be decapitated and overwhelmed by chaos, and then the pestilence would scythe down everyone else. But how could Hunter expect to avoid infection? Why go back to Sebastopol even though he realized that the illness could have been transmitted to him as well? It was becoming clear to Homer that the Brigadier was not acting on intuition, but implementing some kind of plan, step by step, until the old man had spoiled his game. So Sebastopol was doomed in any case, and the expedition was completely meaningless now. But even in order to return home and die quietly beside Elena, Homer would have to complete his round-the-world voyage. The journey from Kharkovka to Kashira had been enough to put their gas masks out of action, and the protective suits had absorbed tens, if not hundreds, of rations. They had to be disposed of as soon as possible. He couldn't go back the same way he had come. What should he do? The girl was sleeping, shrunk up tight into a ball. The fire had finally swallowed the plague-infected diary, consumed the final branches, and gone out. To save the batteries of his flashlight, the old man decided to sit in darkness for as long as he could manage it. No, he had to carry on following the Brigadier. He would avoid everyone else in order to reduce the risk of infection, dump his knapsack here with all his bits and pieces, destroy his clothing. He would hope for mercy, but still count down the 30 days. He would work on his book every day without taking any time to rest. "It will all work out somehow," the old man kept telling himself. "The important thing is to follow Hunter, not to fall behind. That's if he shows up again." It was more than an hour since the Brigadier had disappeared into the blurred opening at the end of the tunnel. When he reassured the girl, Homer was by no means certain that the Brigadier would definitely come back to them. The more the old man learned about him, the less he understood him. It was impossible to trust the Brigadier, but just as impossible to doubt him. He was impossible to analyze. He didn't fit the pattern of normal human emotions. Trusting him was tantamount to surrendering yourself to a force of nature. But Homer had already done it. There was no point in regretting it now. It was too late. In the pitch darkness, the silence didn't seem so dense. Strange mutterings and whispers were hatching through its smooth shell. Something howled in the distance. Something rustled. In some sounds, the old man fancied he heard the shambling, drunken footfalls of the corpse-eaters. In others, he heard the slithering of the phantom giants at Nagornaya, and in some, the cries of dying men. Before even 10 minutes had passed, he surrendered. He clicked the switch and shuddered. Hunter was standing 2 steps away from him with his arms crossed on his chest, staring at the sleeping girl. Blinded by the sudden light, he put his hand over his eyes and said calmly,
"They'll open the door now."
Sasha was dreaming. She was alone at Kolomenskoye again, waiting for her father after one of his strolls. He was late, but she had to wait for him, help him take off his outer clothes, pull off his gas mask, feed him. The table was already laid for lunch, and she didn't know what to busy herself with. She wanted to leave the door leading to the surface, but what if he came back at the very moment when she wasn't there? Who would open it for him? And there she was, sitting on the cold floor beside the door, and the hours flew by. The days came and went, and he still didn't return. But she wouldn't leave her place until the door. She was woken by the hollow clang of a bolt opening, a bolt exactly like the ones on the door at Kolomenskoye. She woke up with a smile. Her father had come back. Then she looked round and remembered everything. The only real part of her rapidly fading vision was the screeching of the gigantic latches on the metal door. A minute later, the immense slab started vibrating and moving slowly. A beam of light poured through the widening crack, and diesel fumes seeped out. The entrance to the greater metro. The door gently moved aside and slipped into its groove, revealing the insides of the tunnel,
that led to Autosawod Station, and then onto the circle. Standing on the rails, with its engine growling, all ready to go, was a large motor trolley with a front floodlight and several riders. In the hairlines of their machine gun sight, the men on the trolley saw two travelers wincing at the light and covering their eyes.
"Hands!"
a voice shouted. Sasha followed the old man and obediently raised her hands. This time, the motor trolley was the same one that used to come out across the bridge on trading days. The team on it knew all about Sasha's story, and now the old man with the strange name would regret taking the shackled girl from the empty station without bothering to ask how she came to be there.
"Take off your gas masks! Present your documents!"
the voice ordered from the trolley. As she revealed her face, she castigated herself for being so stupid. Nobody could set her free. No one had annulled the sentence passed on her father, and on Sasha along with them. Why had she believed that these two could take her into the metro? Did she think she wouldn't be noticed at the frontier?
"Hey, you! You can't come in here!"
She had been recognized immediately.
"You've got 10 seconds to disappear! And who's this? Is this your..."
"What's going on?"
asked the old man, bewildered.
"Don't you dare! Leave him alone, it's not him!"
Sasha shouted.
"Clear off!"
the man with an automatic told her in an icy voice.
"Or we'll shoot! To kill!"
"At a girl?"
a second voice asked uncertainly.
"I told you!"
said the first man, snapping the breech of his automatic in anticipation. Sasha backed away and squeezed her eyes shut, preparing to meet death for the third time in the space of a few hours. Something gave a quiet chirrup, and then fell silent. The final order never came. The girl couldn't bear to wait any longer, and she half opened one eye. The engine was still smoking, with its blue-gray fumes drifting through the torrent of white light pouring out of the projector, which was pointing up at the ceiling. They were all lying on the trolley, or beside it, like gutted dolls, limply dangling arms, unnaturally twisted necks, shattered bodies. Sasha turned away. The man with the shaved head was standing behind her with his pistol lowered, examining the trolley that had been transformed into a meat chopping board. He raised the barrel and squeezed the trigger again.
"That's all now,"
he boomed, satisfied.
"Take off their uniforms and gas masks."
"What for?"
the old man asked with a shudder.
"We're getting changed. We'll drive through Autosawod on their trolley."
Sasha froze, gazing dumbfounded at the killer. Inside her, fright struggled against admiration. Revulsion mingled with gratitude. He had just killed 3 men as if it was nothing, breaking her father's most important commandment. But he had done it to save her life, and the old man's, of course. Could it be a coincidence that he had saved her for the second time? Was she confusing sternness with cruelty? She knew one thing for certain. This man's fearlessness made her forget his deformity. The man with the shaved head went over to the trolley first and started tearing the rubber scalps off his fallen enemies. Then suddenly, he staggered back from the motor trolley as if he had seen the devil in person, holding out both arms in front of himself and repeating one word over and over again.
"Black."
Chapter 9. Air. Fear and terror are not the same thing at all. Fear spurs a man on to take action and be creative. Terror paralyzes the body and blocks the flow of thought. It makes a man less human. Homer had seen enough in his time to know the difference between them. His brigadier, who was not endowed with the ability to experience fear, had proved surprisingly vulnerable to terror. But the old man was even more amazed by what had reduced Hunter to this state. The body from which he had removed the gas mask looked unusual. The face that had appeared from under the black rubber had dark, glossy skin, thick lips, and a broad, flat nose. Homer hadn't seen any black men since the day the music channels on TV stopped working, more than 20 years ago, but it wasn't hard for him to recognize the dead man as simply a member of a different race. Curious, certainly. But what was so frightening about it? The brigadier had already taken a grip on himself. His strange fit had lasted less than a minute. He shone his flashlight on the dark face, growled something unintelligible, and started roughly undressing the obstinate body, and Homer could have sworn he heard the crunch of fingers being broken.
"It's a mockery. Just to remind me again, right? It's inhuman. A punishment like that,"
he wheezed almost inaudibly. Had he taken the man for someone else? Was he mutilating the body in revenge for his own momentary humiliation or settling some older and much more serious score? The old man suppressed his own revulsion, glancing stealthily at the brigadier as he stripped another body. The girl didn't take any part in the looting, and Hunter didn't try to force her. She walked away, sat down on the rails, and lowered her face into her hands. It seemed to Homer that she was crying. Hunter dragged the bodies out through the door and dumped them in a heap. In less than 24 hours, there would be nothing left of them. During a day, mastery of the city passed to creatures so appalling that the fearsome predators of the night hid away deep in their burrows, waiting meekly for their hour to come again. Although the dead man's blood wasn't visible on the dark uniform, it didn't dry out immediately. It felt cold and clammy on Homer's stomach and chest, clinging to him as if he wanted to get back into a living body, causing a horrible itching on his skin and in his mind. He wondered if this masquerade was really necessary, and the only consolation he could find was that it would help him to avoid any more casualties in Alto Sawad Station. If Hunter's calculations proved correct, the guards would take them for their own men and let them through unopposed. But what if they didn't? And was the brigadier even trying to reduce the number of deaths that he left in his wake? Homer found the brigadier's bloodthirstiness repellent, but also intriguing. Self-defense could not justify even a third of all the killings he committed, but it was a matter of something more than plain sadism. What concerned the old man most of all was whether Hunter was heading for Tula simply in order to indulge his craving. Even if the unfortunate people who were trapped at that station couldn't find a cure for the mysterious fever, it didn't mean that they